Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, July 30th. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. First, let's have a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa City area, it'll be partly cloudy. Wind from the northeast at 5 to 15 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 81, a low of 58. Tomorrow, Friday, it'll be partly cloudy, high of 80, a low of 58. And on Saturday, mostly sunny, a high of 83, a low of 62. And on Sunday, partly cloudy, a high of 79, a low of 57. The normal high for this day is 85, the normal low, 64. The record high for today was 106 in 1913. The record low was 47 in 1971. The sun will set tonight at 8:27. It will rise tomorrow at 5:59. We have a little weather story today, this one from meteorologist Katie Putchell. Start to August won't be overheated. Typically, as we start August, temperatures are in the low 80s. It's usually one of our hotter months. This year, at least for the first week of the new month, the Climate Prediction Center is showing a chance of below normal temperatures through August 12th. This aligns with our 9-day forecast, for which we are forecasting high temperatures in the upper 70s during the next week. But if you like warmer weather, the monthly outlook from the Climate Prediction is showing a greater than usual chance of higher temperatures overall in August. And again, that little weather story is from meteorologist Katie Putchell. Now let's turn to the front page of today's Gazette for the first story. University of Iowa starts COVID-19 vaccine trials. Study is sponsored by Pfizer and BioNTech. And the story is by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette. The University of Iowa will start giving trial coronavirus vaccines to volunteers today as part of a research study investigating a potential inoculation against deadly COVID-19. The trial, sponsored by Pfizer and BioNTech, two companies working in concert, aims to enroll 30,000 healthy volunteers willing to take the investigational vaccines, which the U.S. Food and Drug Administration hasn't formally approved because they're being tested. The University of Iowa portion of the trial will involve about 250 volunteers, ages 18 to 85, who are generally healthy, not pregnant, and have jobs or engage in activities that put them at heightened risk of contracting COVID-19. According to Patricia Weinoker, Executive Dean of the University of Iowa College of Medicine and Principal Investigator for the University of Iowa trial site. Examples of those high-risk jobs include food industry workers and frontline healthcare providers, she said. Quote, "It is important to enroll a diverse population to ensure that the vaccine is equally effective in different ages, races, genders," Weinoker said. The study's vaccines, aiming to help a body produce antibodies to fight off the disease, will be given by injection, according to the University of Iowa Vaccine Research and Education summary of the trial. Quote, "These vaccines are all slightly different, but work in the same way," the summary said. The study also will test each of these vaccines at different dose levels. In stressing the impetus for the investigation, the university notes COVID-19's global spread. It has infected 16.8 million internationally, 4.4 million in the United States, and nearly 43,200 people in Iowa so far. It has killed more than 661,300 globally, 149,400 nationally, and 844 in this state. According to Weinoker, the University of Iowa trial summary, participants will receive either a test vaccine or a placebo that looks like the study vaccine but does not contain active ingredients. For this trial, the placebo will contain saline. Everyone in the study will get two injections. For every one person who receives the vaccine, another person will get a placebo. The two injections will come either 3 weeks or 2 months apart, according to the university. A participant could be in the study for up to 26 months and would need to visit a study site at least 6 times, plus any time after experiencing COVID-19 symptoms and after feeling better. Enrollment aims to finish in 3 months. Weineker said, quote, "We have received vaccine for a portion of the subjects who will be enrolled at Iowa, and additional doses will be shipped as we use up our initial allocated stock. Trial participants must give about 25 milliliters of blood 5 times over the study duration, used to test antibody levels," according to the university. Quote, "And we will be soliciting information on whether the participants have evidence of sore arm, fever, muscle aches from the vaccine, and then we'll be evaluating for evidence of COVID infection throughout the study," Weineker said, stressing that participants will be followed for 2 years to see if they develop symptoms of COVID. Researchers also will be taking nasal swabs to check for new illnesses consistent with COVID-19, because half of the subjects will be getting a placebo half will be getting the active vaccine. They'll compare onset of COVID-19 infection between the test groups, and they'll evaluate antibody responses. Weineker said, quote, "But the true test is the ability to prevent infection." The University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics has been at the forefront of COVID-19 related research since the illness began its spread nationally, affording it the opportunity to offer trial treatments to its coronavirus patients, including convalescent plasma and remdesivir. The National Institutes of Health this week announced the start of the country's first large clinical trial to investigate a COVID-19 vaccine, co-developed by biotechnology company Moderna, Incorporated, and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. That trial is expected to enroll about 30,000 adults who don't have COVID-19. A New York Times report on the trial indicates researchers will observe whether fewer vaccinated people contract COVID-19, and also whether the vaccine can avert severe cases of the disease and death. That Times report mentions Pfizer's recent announcement it, too, has begun a late-stage COVID-19 vaccine study, working with BioNTech to enroll 30,000 people from 39 states in this country, Brazil, Argentina, and Germany. The federal government last week announced a $1.95 billion deal to buy 100 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine by year's end, if the trial proves successful. We will turn to another story from the front page of today's Gazette. S-curve traffic shifts on I-380 through fall. Work north of downtown Cedar Rapids brings detour. And this story is by Alexandra Scores of the Gazette. Already, no leisurely Sunday drive. A busy section of Interstate 380's S-curve north of downtown Cedar Rapids will be more dicey for drivers through November. A $1.3 million project to overlay bridge decking already has shifted northbound and southbound lanes and will affect traffic patterns more in the days ahead. Stephen McElmeel, construction manager for the Iowa Department of Transportation's District 6, said crews are putting in a median crossover in preparation for a detour. The repair work on the northbound lanes of the bridge will be done in 2 stages. First, the inside 2 lanes will be closed, then the outside 2 lanes will be closed. Some of the northbound traffic will be diverted over the temporary median crossing. Some of the northbound traffic will be diverted over the temporary median crossing to travel in what is now a southbound lane, according to Newman Albuissa, Newman L. Let me begin that again. According to Newman Albuisa, resident construction engineer, only one northbound lane will cross over for about half a mile and then cross back over to the usual northbound lanes, Albuisa said. Despite the shift, southbound interstate traffic will maintain three lanes. The shoulder will be used to shift the lanes over. Southbound traffic will never cross over to the median. For the duration of the construction, the H Avenue on-ramp to southbound I-380 will be closed. From about mid to late to September until the end of construction, the J Street H Avenue off-ramp from northbound I-380 also will be closed. Catherine Cutler, an Iowa DOT district transportation planner, said the area under construction, about between 8th Street and H Avenue Northeast, sees up to 87,000 vehicles per day. The segment under construction is near city-operated automated cameras that issue tickets for speeding. However, Iowa DOT intends to keep the limit at 55 miles per hour. The agency said it would keep an eye on the speed and post advisory speeds if warranted in the work zone. The project will last until the end of construction season this year, likely November. Now we'll turn to the inside page of the Gazettes, to the Iowa Today page. Iowa City School Board reviewing its policy on racial equity. At issue, curriculum, law enforcement, patrolling of school campuses. And the story is by Grace King of the Gazette. The Iowa City Community School District will be reviewing having police officers patrol school parking lots as it takes steps to address racial equity and diversity in the district. The district also will audit its curriculum to ensure it is without bias, and it will create a plan to recruit and retain teachers and administrators of color. School board members met with the district's equity committee in a work session Tuesday night to discuss how the district can respond to Black Lives Matter demands made by the Iowa Freedom Riders. The group shared the demands with the school board earlier this month. Topics included cutting ties with the Johnson County law enforcement, reviewing the referral process to alternative schools, and rewriting a discipline protocol to be free of language that targets students of color. The demands were a launching point for a letter written by the Equity Committee to the school board, which outlined recommended actions toward disavowing racism, hate, and discrimination, said Rebecca Tilley, an Equity Committee member. Among the Equity Committee recommendations are, first, retain an equity program facility position, which has been a critical part of developing and implementing a diversity, equity, and inclusion plan. Second, limit police presence by not having officers routinely patrol school grounds or come onto grounds except by request. Third, remove racist instructional materials from classrooms and add proactive and anti-racist curriculum at all grade levels. Fourth, increase funding for school counselors and social workers. And fifth, track retention rates of teachers and administrators of color. While the Equity Committee is appreciative of the school board's previous vote to not fund school resource officers in school buildings, the committee wants the board to agree that any decision to add school resource officers in the future would require supermajority board approval. Even without school resource officers in buildings, officers regularly patrol school grounds, an issue for some students of color, Tilley said. Quote, it doesn't create a welcoming environment and culture for a number of students, Tilley told the Gazette. It doesn't mean we can't make that phone call if there's a reason we need police presence, but it shouldn't be casually patrolling those areas. Tilley also said the district needs a robust equity review process when it comes to curriculum, though that has been paused because of budget concerns. A fifth grade textbook no longer is in use because of the problematic representation of slavery it presented, said Tilley, who chaired the Lucas Elementary PTO Racial Climate Subcommittee before joining the Equity Committee this year. Carolyn Barker, a student on the Equity Committee, said anti-racist teaching can be added to history curriculum in the high schools as well. No action was taken during the work session, and the board plans to continue the discussion at a board retreat next month. Jane Finch, chairwoman of the Equity Committee, told the Gazette she thinks the interim superintendent, Matt Denger, said it best. If we can get the culture right, where everyone in the school district, staff, students, and teachers all feel supported, then the achievement gap, the disparities in discipline, it will all follow from there. And also from the Iowa Today page, we have this little story. North Liberty urges residents to wear masks in public. City also calls on businesses to require face covering. And this story is by Lee Hermiston of the Gazette. North Liberty is calling on its residents to mask up when in public. During its meeting Tuesday night, the North Liberty City Council unanimously adopted a face mask resolution, asking those in the city to wear face coverings while in public and to social distance. North Liberty businesses also are asked to adopt mask policies. Quote, reducing the transmission of SARS-CoV-2, the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, is critical to our schools' reopenings, our businesses' recoveries, and our community's health, the city said in a news release announcing the measure. Face coverings keep transmission low, prevent our hospitals from being overwhelmed, and protect our community members who are vulnerable. Iowa City, Coralville, and Johnson County also have called on citizens to wear masks in public. To date, only Iowa City's mask mandate comes with a potential fine for noncompliance. However, Johnson County, whose county supervisors do not have the same authority as mayors, is taking the steps to also enact a measure that would be punishable with fines. North Liberty Communications Director Nick Burgess said the city was not interested in gaining compliance through fines. Quote, the goal is to encourage masks in our communities to save lives, help businesses recover, help schools reopen, and keep our community healthy, not to fine or arrest folks, Burgess said. This is about education, not enforcement. The measure is effective immediately and asks that citizens wear a cloth mask or face shield in public settings when social distancing is not possible, indoors or outdoors, and share using public or shared transportation. And now we'll turn to another story from the Iowa Today page. This one, Marion Airport completes project to widen runway. Grand opening is set for Friday at noon, and this story is by Gage Miskimen of the Gazette. The Marion Municipal Airport is back to business as usual after completing a runway widening project. The airport at 1690 Marion Airport Road reopened its runway Friday, but a grand opening event is scheduled for noon this Friday. The runway has been widened from 23 feet to 60 feet. The project also included additional grading, drain tile, runway lighting, and other safety improvements, city engineer Mike Barkalow said. Barkalow said, quote, with a wider runway, we're making it safer. It's also another gateway into town. We're not a river town. We have highways 13 and 100, but we don't have Interstate 380. The hope is this is another way to drive business. The project cost $1.8 million, with $424,000 of that funded by an Iowa Department of Transportation grant, as well as other grants for the runway design and zoning. The rest of the cost is covered by city bonds. The airport, which has been privately owned, now is managed by Lux Air Aviation, but the city of Marion has owned the runway since 2015 in a public-private partnership. That change allowed the city to seek funding for improvements from the IDOT, Barkalow said. Barkalow said the city has no other projects planned for the airport in the near future, but there will be a meeting soon to discuss next steps. There is potential to extend the runway north as well, but that would run across Airport Road, requiring it to close, he said. He said, quote, "It's been closed for quite a while, so we want them to get their feet back under them." And now I'll take a sip of coffee and then I'll turn to the other inside page story. All right, now we're on the insight page of the Gazette, and first we have community letter. This just one letter today. This one is from Brian Anderson of Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids rental scooters are a recipe for disaster. As a lifelong Cedar Rapidian and a bicycle commuter for over 20 years, I applaud the development decisions made by our city leaders when it comes to the trail system and bicycle infrastructure. Our downtown has become more accessible and more attractive to families looking for a destination on a bike ride. I am not, however, thrilled at the result of the recent introduction of rental scooters to the downtown area. What was intended to be an incentive to draw tourism to the downtown area has become a dangerous nuisance, comprised mostly of middle or high school-aged kids who roam in packs on the scooters, disregarding traffic laws and the safety of themselves and others. My father and I had a near miss a few days ago when an entire family on scooters, no helmets, ignored a stop sign and drove into the street in front of him. He had not stopped his vehicle in Had he not stopped his vehicle in anticipation, a girl who looked to be about 10 years old would have been injured or worse. I implore our city leaders to reconsider the scooter idea. Reduce the number of scooters on the road, limit their operational range, issue citations to operators who violate traffic laws. Something needs to change before lives are lost. And again, that letter is from Brian Anderson of Cedar Rapids. And also on the inside page of the Gazette, we have the Todd Dorman column. This is the 24-hour Dorman column. Trashing voting for political gain. It worked so well, Republicans had to trash it. County auditors in Iowa who received absentee ballot request forms from voters with some information missing, such as the voter PIN number, nobody knows, could simply fill in that information from voter database records. The voter would then be mailed a ballot. Public servants serving the public. The system worked great in June, when a record number of Iowans voted in party primaries. Most voted safely by mail amid the coronavirus pandemic. A victory for democracy. Naturally, Republicans who run the legislature who are always thinking up new barriers to voting couldn't let it stand. They passed a bill barring auditors from filling in missing information. Instead, they'd have to contact voters by email, phone, or mail, raising the prospect some voters would not receive a ballot due to a technicality. This is a feature, not a flaw. Similar language passed a few years ago was thrown out by a Polk County judge. The League of United Latin American Citizens and a Democratic group majority forward, have filed a lawsuit to overturn the new law. Solon County Auditor Joel Miller and Johnson County Auditor Travis Weipert, both Democrats, looked upon this change and found it doesn't say anything about barring auditors from sending voters ballot request forms with all the pertinent information already filled out. So that's what they did. The Iowa Legislative Council tried to stop them. But at last check, the 24-member panel of lawmakers can't make law. Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate also has scolded the auditors, and his office's lawyer, according to reporting by Laura Beelan at the website Bleeding Heartland, sent Miller and Weipert's letters demanding documents and asking a list of questions. It seems Pate may be fixing to go to court. The Republican National Committee is urging Pate to take action. The RNC wants the Lynn and Johnson mailings declared invalid and each voter notified as such. Never mind that thousands of request forms already have been returned. One of the RNC's claims is that Lynn and Johnson voters will face a lower chance of being denied a ballot by this lousy law than Iowans in other counties, violating the constitutional right to equal protection. Suppress every vote equally. You can't make this stuff up. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign, the Republican Party of Iowa, the RNC, and other GOP groups are seeking to intervene in the lawsuit aimed at striking down the new law. They want the stuff. They want the suit dismissed. Why are Republicans working so hard to make it harder to vote? They claim it's to fight voter fraud. Voter fraud is everywhere. That strange noise you hear in the night? Voter fraud. The reason your dog is barking at seemingly nothing? Voter fraud. Worried about COVID-19? Voter fraud is far worse. In reality, Republicans fear Donald Trump might lose a tight race in Iowa. Ditto with U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and U.S. House candidates. When more people vote, especially in places like Johnson and Lynn counties, the GOP believes its candidates face tough sledding. So, yet another system that worked gets trashed. Republicans should be ashamed if they weren't so shameless. And again, that is Todd Dorman's column. And now, for a little message, you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, July 30th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. First, we have the short notices from Cedar Rapids. Dr. Alan Joseph Novak Sr. died Saturday, July 25th. Arrangements are with the Hrabek Newhouse Funeral Service of Belle Plaine. From Cedar Rapids, Kevin Richeson, 57, died Wednesday, July 29th. Arrangements are with the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center of Cedar Rapids. From Elkader, Charles, also known as Chuck Eugene Peterman, 71, died Tuesday, July 28th. Arrangements are with the Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Elkader. From Lamont, Cletus Clayson, 70, died Wednesday, July 29th. Arrangements are with the Clarkson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. From Strawberry Point, Claire, also known as Bub Kruger, 74, of Strawberry Point, formerly of Littleport, died Monday, July 27th. Arrangements are with the Leonard Muller Funeral Home of Strawberry Point. From Wadena, Virginia Gage, 84, died Saturday, July 25th. Arrangements are with the Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of West Union. From Waukon, Dorothy Wandling, 90, died Tuesday, July 27th. Arrangements are with the Mountain Martin Grau Funeral Home of Waukon. Dropping down the page now, we have the longer notices from Anamosa, Margaret Jane Pilcher, 96, died peacefully Sunday, July 26th, at her home following a brief illness, surrounded by her six sons. A private mass of Christian burial will be held Saturday, August 1st, at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Anamosa, with interment in the Holy Cross Cemetery. The Reverend Father Nick March will officiate. Goetz Funeral Home has taken Margaret and her family into their care. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Jones County Senior Center and St. Patrick Catholic Church in Anamosa. Masks may be worn and fitted properly over the nose and mouth at all times in the church. Social distancing must be practiced as well. From Cedar Rapids, Elizabeth, known as Betty Ann Zobeck, 92, of Cedar Rapids, died Tuesday, May 5th, at the Mercy Hospice House in Hiawatha. A private graveside service will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Alan Naylor passed away Monday, July 27th, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A memorial visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to noon, Saturday, August 1st, at Van Steenhuis Russell Funeral Home, followed by interment at the Urbana Cemetery. A celebration of life picnic will be held at D.L. Anderson Park in Vinton, immediately following interment. From Cedar Rapids, Mary Ann Szabo, that's spelled S-Z-A-B-O, 82, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, July 27th, at Westridge Care Center. Visitation will be from 3 to 4 p.m., Sunday, August 2nd, with a celebration of life to follow at 4 p.m. at Church of the King, 3750 F Avenue Northwest in Cedar Rapids. The Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids assisted the family with arrangements. From Coggin, Fred Barnhouse, 76, of Coggin, passed away Monday, July 27th, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Per his wishes, cremation has taken place. Burial will take place at God's Acres Cemetery in Claremont at a later date. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, Clarence, also known as Werdehoff, that's spelled W-R-O-R-D-E-H-O-F-F, 77, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Wednesday, July 29th, at Heritage Specialty Care after a brief illness. Per family wishes, no services will be held at this time. From Coralville, Edith Elida Anderson, 95, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, July 29th, at the Solon Nursing Care Center from COVID-19. Family committal services will be held at Oak Hill Cemetery in Coralville. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Friends of the Animal Center Foundation. From Marion, Rose Elma Stone, 83, of Marion, passed away at Winslow House Care Center on Sunday, July 26th. Following a long battle with Alzheimer's. To honor Rose's wishes, no services will be held at this time. Now we'll turn to the sports page. Well, we have, it's tournament time in Iowa. We have this lead story on the sports page about girls softball. Cougars on the cusp. Kennedy to face Fort Dodge today for Class 5A Crown. The story is by Jeff Linder of the Gazette. Fort Dodge. Season after season, year after year, their routine has been the same. Kaylin Kinney pitched, Abby Spore caught. Together, they dreamed. Quote, "We've talked about it a lot," Spore said. "We've always said, "Someday, someday, and now. Someday is tomorrow," Spore said. Spore and Maya Dodge proved the perils of pitching around Kinney, hitting back-to-back third-inning home runs to give second-ranked Cedar Rapids Kennedy some separation. Then Kinney dented the upper reaches of an evergreen tree well beyond the left field fence with a sixth-inning missile, and the Cougars routed number 8 Muscatine 9-0 in a Class 5A semifinal at the state softball tournament at the Rogers Sports Complex. Quote, "It feels amazing," said Kinney, who also pitched a four-hit shutout as the Cougars, at 25-1, won their 18th consecutive game. Quote, "This is like a dream. It's unreal." Kennedy advances to the state finals for the first time in state history. There, the Cougars will face number 1 Fort Dodge at 28-3, a 5-3 victor over number 6 Ankeny Centennial at 5 p.m. today. The Cougars will be the first Metro finalist since Linmar was the 2006 4A runner-up. With another win, they could be the first. They could be the first Metro champion since Jefferson won two in a row in 1997 and 1998. Quote, "I'm so excited," Spore said. "I literally can't wait." Kennedy has homered 6 times in 2 games here this week. Kinney and Dodge have gone deep twice apiece. Muscatine at 9-13. Let me try that again. Muscatine at 19-3 elected to walk Kinney intentionally the first 2 times she came to the plate, including a leadoff pass in the bottom of the 3rd, and the Cougars in front 1-0. Bypassing Kinney has its benefits, and Wednesday it had its consequences. Dodge laced a 2-0 pitch over the left field fence, and Spore followed with another blast to make it 4-0. Quote, "When they walk Kalen, they just want to make it hurt," Spore said. "Our 2-3-4 hitters work together as a team instead of as a competition." With 2 runners on base and no outs in the 6th, there wasn't much choice but to pitch to Kinney. On the 2nd pitch, the University of Nebraska signee smoked a 3-1 3-run blast beyond the fence, beyond a 2nd fence, and 3/4 the way up the evergreen. Consensus in the press box had the shot conservatively at 275 feet. Quote, "They threw a new pitcher at me, and I just wanted to stay in the moment, stay in the at-bat," Kinney said. The meat of the order provided the fireworks, but it was number 8 hitter Sam Schneck, who put the Cougars in front with a 2-out RBI single in the 2nd. Quote, "I just wanted to hit it to the grass and move the runners around," said Schick, who also started the 6th-inning rally with a leadoff single. "We like to pass the bat from one hitter to the next." All right. Now we have high school boys baseball. City High's magical run come to an end. And the story is by K.J. Pilcher of the Gazette, Des Moines. Iowa City High's postseason has been filled with late-inning magic. The Little Hawks already had produced 2 walk-off, come-from-behind wins, and appeared to reach in their... Let me start that again, see if I can get it right. The Little Hawks already had produced 2 walk-off, come-from-behind wins, and appeared to reach in their ball caps and conjure one more charmed finish. But for City High, its spell and season came to an end. Dubuque Hempstead's Andrew Henry lofted a fly ball to left field that was misplayed with 2 outs in the bottom of the 7th, allowing 2 runs to score. That propelled the third-seeded Mustangs to a 7-6 victory over City High in the Class 4A state baseball quarterfinals last night at Principal Park. Quote, "We battled back," City High coach Brian Mitchell said. "We finally got things going and put a lot of pressure on them, and I thought that pressure had a lot of impact on the game. It just didn't work out at the end of the day. I'm not disappointed in our effort. It was a great experience for us. But I'm telling you, when you see seniors Reese, Hayden, Garrett, Borman, Colby, Schoenblen, Noah Kebet played a great right field, and Kyle Clark didn't get a chance tonight. You talk about what those guys have done the last couple years. It's hard to put this one behind us. The Little Hawks at 11-9 fell into a 5-1 hole after the second inning and rebounded for the one-run lead in the seventh before the heartbreaking conclusion. City High is no stranger to tight postseason contests. They were tied or behind in both sub-state games, earning their first state berth since 2003. The Little Hawks trailed by one in their final at-bat, and the rally started immediately. Egan Smith opened with a single and moved to second on Borman's sacrifice. Carter Seaton beat out a hopper to shortstop. A late errant throw went out of play, allowing Smith to score and sending Seaton to second as the go-ahead run. Gable Smith walked, and Schnobelen singled to center, but a good relay cut Seaton down at the plate for the second out. Hempstead's second error of the inning gave the Little Hawks another shot, and Kate Obermuller's walk, bases loaded, put them ahead. Hempstead put the tying and game-winning run on base with Michael Garrett's one-out walk and Zach Sabers getting hit by a pitch with two outs. After a pitching change, Henry came up and put the ball in play. The confusing sequence included the ball landing by two Little Hawk defenders, base runners stumbling around third and Sabers sliding home in front of a relay throw. The ending was difficult to process for the Little Hawks, leaving some of them stunned. Quote, "It just doesn't seem real," Hayden said. "I've been playing this game ever since I could walk. Now it's over. It's a really weird feeling." And with that, we'll turn to the back page of the Gazette for the Dear Abby column. Girlfriend's presence has added pain for X. "Dear Abby, my boyfriend of 2 years, Kevin, recently broke up with me. We've had problems in the past about me lying to him or withholding information. I lied because he had high expectations of me and I didn't want to disappoint. He truly is the first person I have loved unconditionally since the breakup with my child's father 5 years ago. Kevin and I still are friends, sometimes with benefits, but he has moved on to another woman. I'm heartbroken, and it has taken a toll. When I visited recently, I realized she practically has moved in. She has her toiletries over there. I want my boyfriend back. Kevin and I had talked about a life together, buying a house, taking trips, even getting married. But I'm worried this new woman will get the life with the man I love. What advice, if any, can you offer me?" And this is signed, Left Behind in Alabama. "Dear Left Behind, it appears your ex-boyfriend is enjoying the benefits of being with two women, and your heart is getting broken. It is time for you to move on, because a new chick has all but moved into the nest you shared with Kevin. One has to wonder whether she is aware he has a FWB in addition to her. I bet the answer is no. And I wonder what kind of a man behaves as you have described. In your next relationship, I hope you realize that you are good enough just as you are. And there's no reason you must live up to anyone else's expectations." That is the Dear Abby column. And now we'll move on to another story after I have a sip of coffee. All right, this is This is the living page of the Gazette. This story is called is More Than a Farm. Walker Homestead offers pizzas, events, and classes outside Iowa City. And the story is by Allison Goins of the Gazette. Christy and Bob Walker just meant to trade in their Iowa City house for a rural home where they could garden and perhaps retire in an idyllic setting that reminded Christy of the farm she grew up on. Quote, "My goal was to see how much food I could get from the farm," she said. "I started out on a farm. I want to end on a farm." Soon, however, they found themselves growing so many vegetables, they started a small CSA, that's Community Supported Agriculture Program, to sell them to friends and neighbors. Then they started hosting dinner parties in their backyard, and soon people started asking if they could hold their weddings or other events on their land. The Walkers started to see the potential for their small patch of rolling hills to be something more. They decided to expand, purchasing 80 acres next to the initial couple of acres, and house they had bought just west of Iowa City. That was about 5 years ago, and they've been transforming the property ever since, converting it from commodity corn and soybeans to pasture land, vegetable production, and vineyards. Last year, they built an events barn and started opening Walker Homestead to the public for weddings, private parties, and meals, and classes on the farm. "It's, quote, it's been a journey," Christy Walker said. They joined forces with Chef Chris Grebner, who became a co-owner of the venture. Grebner owns Provender, a wood-fire pizza mobile food truck and catering company, and the Farmer's Table, which hosted farm-to-table meals throughout the community. He met the Walkers after they volunteered to host a Farmer's Table event on their land. Quote, "A kitchen on a farm was what I had been working toward. This relationship has really blown that dream up and out," Grebner said. "I enjoy learning, watching the produce growing. I like the challenge of working with familiar products and trying to push things a little bit, to try new things." He works directly with Walker Homestead's farmer, Kyle Laws, to decide what to plant and to plan each week's menus. Every Sunday, the farm is open for dining. People can come for pizza, salads, and other dishes, plus wine from the vineyard, and find their own social distance spot on the land to enjoy their meals. Quote, "The freshness really jumps off the plate," Law said. It's been really great collaborating so closely with the chef. Each Wednesday is a rotating activity. Some weeks are pizza nights that mirror the Sunday meals. Before the coronavirus pandemic arrived, they planned to do live classes, wine tastings, and outdoor farm dinners on other Wednesdays. Those dinners, which in the past Grebner served on a long communal table, are on hiatus, and classes and wine tastings have become virtual events. Said Bob Walker, quote, "Our mission is to build community through agricultural education and culinary delights. We figure a lot of people don't know where and how their food is raised." This year, they hired winemaker Jenny Lovatinsky For now, their vineyard and winery is small, with their wines mostly sold on the farm. They use all Iowa grapes, though their vines are not productive enough yet to only use their own. The farm also includes Highland cattle, goats, heritage turkey, chickens, and rabbits. Christy Walker hopes to get sheep to keep the vineyard mowed. Quote, "It's exciting to feel the diversity of the land and see the permaculture and seed keeping it all in balance, Christie said. Our goal is that this is a productive farm to showcase farming that's both useful and beautiful. They're slowly adding more elements in the front of the property. Evergreen saplings are the start of a future Christmas tree operation. They recently planted a chestnut orchard. Everything, Christie Walker said, is looking to the future. Establishing all these things will take years of effort, and they hope their children and grandchildren, along with Grebner's family, will keep it going long after they're all ready to fully retire. Their goal is... Let me begin that again. Their goal is for the entire farm to be organic certified, which takes time. They're also working on things such as planting filter strips to keep runoff out of stream beds and other eco-friendly efforts. Said Bob Walker, quote, "We're trying to build the soil health back." He said the agritourism aspect is important to make the venture financially viable. They've had ongoing discussions with the County Board of Supervisors on how they should be zoned and the number of types of events they can have without needing to make infrastructure improvements like paving the gravel road leading up to their farm, which the Walkers said would be cost prohibitive. The Iowa legislature passed a law this year exempting agricultural experiences from special use permits and variances, which Christie Walker believes will allow them to have events throughout the year instead of just the 120 days they've been limited to. She said, quote, I feel like this is our work of art. It's ever-changing. All the seasons are beautiful. Both the Walkers have other jobs. Christie Walker retired from a career at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics and now teaches part-time at the University of Iowa Tippey College of Business and works for Mahaska Health in Oskaloosa. Bob Walker teaches at the University of Iowa John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center. Walker said, quote, Bob thought, let me begin that again. Christie Walker said, quote, Bob thought we were too old to start farming. I told him, farming keeps you young. We're going to be going full steam until we drop. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, July 30th. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.